Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast. I'm Pat Iyer, the host of this show. I started Legal Nurse Podcast in September of 2016 as a way to connect with legal nurse consultants, and that has been successful. We have listeners in over 105 countries around the world, and I'm excited to be able to bring you tips and knowledge about this specialized field. I would love to have your comments on the show, or compliments, or suggestions. Please go to podcast.legalnursebusiness.com and look for a red button on the homepage where you can leave a message for me and share your comments. In this series of podcasts coming up next, I will be spending some time focusing on a skilled role for legal nurse consultants, that is, of being an expert witness. Arlene Klopatsky, who is a nurse attorney, and I have put together a course called Expert Witness Mastery for Nurses. It is beginning in the first week of May and will run for 4 weeks in May on Tuesday nights. And Arlene and I will be teaching you the skills that help you expand an expert witness practice. We're going to be giving you 4 live sessions that will include opportunities for interaction and to gain a deeper understanding of how to be a successful expert witness. This course is based in part on a book that I released this spring, 2024, called How to Be a Successful Nursing Expert Witness, Second Edition. Be sure to go to the link below this video, which is lnc.tips/expert-witness-course. You will receive the tips that you need to feel comfortable in this role and expand your caseload. If you see this video after the course has run, we will have the recordings that you'll be able to watch at your convenience. Now let's get on to the show. Welcome to the podcast. I am Pat Iyer, and this is Legal Nurse Podcast, specifically geared to help you as a legal nurse consultant learn more and function effectively in your business, get more clients, get more cases, and grow your business. One of the most common areas of practice for us as legal nurse consultants is medical malpractice, and obstetrical malpractice is a key area that comes up pretty frequently when we are evaluating cases. I have with me today 2 expert witnesses who are nurses who have a specialty in labor and delivery cases. They have over 18 years of experience in women's health, namely labor and delivery, and a passion for helping women and their families to make sure that they receive the best care. This is indeed a vulnerable time, and we picked a topic that puts this vulnerability in the spotlight. Courtney Morehouse and Sasha Benner are my guests today. And let's start, first of all, by talking about a complication which, if not managed properly, can be devastating, and that is bleeding. In the course of a pregnancy, what are some of the times when bleeding can occur?
So bleeding can actually occur pretty much the entirety of your pregnancy, all the way from implantation, obviously, through to that postpartum period, you know, at about the 6 to 12 weeks after delivery period. So we were just going to touch on a couple of those things that you might not think about all the time. First one, implantation bleeding. That can be about 10 to 14 days after conception. It's just a little bit of bleeding. It's not abnormal. A lot of people might mistake this for the beginning of their period, you know, unless they're specifically trying to get pregnant. So that's a common one, just a little bit of spotting in and out, does not last for very long. Other than that, the kind of those really early stages of pregnancy, any type of ectopic pregnancy can cause bleeding. And honestly, the only way to know about those is to go to your provider and get it checked out, because those can certainly be life-threatening. A miscarriage, a threatened miscarriage, anything along those lines can also certainly cause bleeding. And then another big one that a lot of our patients will come into triage for is cervical irritation, especially after intercourse or having any type of exam, like a transvaginal ultrasound or a speculum exam. Anything that causes that cervical irritation can cause bleeding or spotting, which is obviously really concerning during pregnancy. And moving on into the what we call it, maybe the bigger topics for bleeding would be an abruption, any type of placenta previa, whether it's a complete one that covers the opening of the cervix or just a partial one, or an accreta where the placenta and everything is growing outside of the uterus, which is obviously not good for anybody. Uterine rupture, preterm labor can also cause some of that bleeding. Again, at any point, we obviously would not, we don't like our patients to go into labor until they're, you know, probably at the 37 week mark, but obviously it happens earlier. And then if you are in labor, you can have bleeding with just standard cervical change. If you change really quickly, say from 1 centimeter to 8 centimeters, your cervix is like, what is going on? So bleeding during labor is normal. And then what most people associate bleeding and pregnancy with is obviously after delivery and the baby is out. But just knowing that bleeding is common but not necessarily normal during pregnancy, and the safest bet, you know, if you're not sure what it is, you know, call a triage nurse, go into triage, go to the ED urgent care and get that checked out, because they're going to be able to give a lot more information on if it's, you know, something, you know, just keep an eye on it, but nothing to be too concerned about. Or, you know, hey, we need to keep a closer eye on you. And, you know, maybe we need to send you up to triage for labor and delivery, depending on how pregnant you are. So.
And let's focus on the big one, as you made reference to, the postpartum hemorrhage, which seems to be the one that creates the most trouble, at least clinically, other than the placental issues that you mentioned. The idea for a jury that a woman could bleed out in a postpartum unit is incomprehensible. Tell us about how that postpartum bleeding risk factors are looked at so that they can be, the risk of bleeding can be detected quickly, and then the staff are thinking about that as they're taking care of the mom after delivery.
So every hospital, and please keep in mind, every hospital system has their own standard operating procedures on, you know, how things are done, when things are done. So just kind of blanket, please check your individual facility. But every facility that Courtney and I have ever worked at, which are mainly military facilities right now, have always had a postpartum hemorrhage risk assessment that is embedded within your admission assessment, your shift assessments, those types of things. So typically those are done on admission, before, right before delivery, and then when the patient is transferred to that postpartum unit. As with any type of ongoing assessment, say for example, falls, you are absolutely encouraged to reassess your patient at any point throughout their stay, especially the course of labor, because things can always change. So typically these assessments are done by both the nurses and the providers, and they're trying to determine within reason if your patient is at a low, medium, or high risk for a postpartum hemorrhage. And again, the criteria on what's considered low, medium, and high is going to be a little bit different for every hospital, but are typically about the same. So for those low risk patients, which is most patients, is that you don't have any uterine incisions, you don't have a previous C-section, you haven't had any, you know, type of fibroids or anything like that removed. This is a singleton pregnancy. You've had less than 4 previous deliveries. You don't have any bleeding disorders that you know of, and you haven't had any previous postpartum hemorrhages. So honestly, that's a majority of our patients. Certainly, if you work in a high risk hospital and a high risk unit, that might not be most of your patients. But you know, for your more like community or regional hospitals that don't have, you know, they're not seeing all these super complicated patients, that's most women. The medium risk factor is, you know, if you've had a previous C-section, any type of uterine surgery, say fibroid removal, twin gestation, triplets, those by themselves kind of bump you into a high-risk pregnancy category all on their own. If you've had more than 4 previous vaginal deliveries, a history of postpartum hemorrhage with any pregnancy, you know that you have large uterine fibroids. They have an estimated fetal weight for your current pregnancy of greater than 4 kilograms, maternal morbid obesity, and chorio, which is an infection within the uterus. And then for those patients that are high risk, and again, you can always go up. You can start at low and go up to high. You can't start at high and go back down to low. That's not how it works. For those high risk patients, it's the complete placenta previa, low lying placenta, the suspected placenta accreta, hematocrit of less than 30, platelets less than 100,000. If you have any active bleeding upon admission, known clotting type of issues, or an active abruption going on. And for those patients, you know, everybody knows that they're a high risk. You know, all of the nurses, all of the providers know what's going on. And typically for our low and medium risk patients upon admission, when you get your admission labs, we will get a type and screen on those moms. And then with the high risk moms, we do a type and cross for 2 units. So kind of one of those things to think about, you know, is if you have a mom that went from a low risk to a high risk, you'd be like, oh, I need to call lab and change my type and screen to a type and cross, just in case. As I'm sure Courtney will touch on, labor and delivery nurses are very superstitious. So anything that we can do to ward off evil spirits, as far as postpartum hemorrhages or emergencies, we can and will do. And then obviously making sure, like, you know, if you're like, hey, I really think this patient is now, you know, high risk for bleeding, like, I'm going to make sure that all, you know, my doctors know, my midwives know, you know, your charge nurse knows, whoever's coming to delivery with you, because labor and delivery is not, you know, one nurse and one doctor type of situation. You need more hands than that. So we do those again at the beginning at admission, and some people are admitted for an induction where they're not in labor at all. And some people are admitted, you know, at 9 centimeters, like I need to push right now. So you may have assessments that are done very far apart from each other. You know, if you have a three day long induction, that's an extended period of time, but it could also be 25 minutes or less in between those assessments being recompleted. So
have you ever run into a situation with a woman who was at high risk for bleeding and also had religious beliefs that prevented her from being willing to accept blood if she would?
I have personally not had any patients that have been adverse to receiving blood. I think most, Courtney, correct me if you've had anybody that I don't know about, but most of the patients are like, they might be very religious and have religious beliefs around receiving blood, but typically when it comes to labor and delivery related, like, needs for blood, that they are very on board with getting blood. Mm-hmm. And again, if you have a patient that is like, I don't want to receive blood products, you know, same with if you have a DNR, DNI, like, they sign that paperwork, they are well educated by both the nurse, the providers, everybody that needs to educate the patient, and they're well within their rights to say, I decline all blood products.
Mm-hmm.
So, but typically that's not most pregnant, essentially young, healthy, adult pregnant women.
So I have had specifically a Jehovah's Witness. I've only had one in my whole time, and she absolutely refused any blood products. So before delivery, we went over medications that we could give her that were safe to give her that were not blood products to minimize her risk for bleeding and to give those kind of prophylactically. And she accepted all of them. So for that particular patient, luckily she didn't end up bleeding, whether that was because we gave her those medications or because she just wasn't going to bleed to begin with. We ended up giving her some Cytotec immediately after delivery, which is kind of a extended release medication that makes sure that uterus gets nice and firm. And then we also gave her TXA, which is another medication that makes sure that uterus doesn't become boggy. And with both of those medications, she ended up doing fine, and it was never an issue for me. But I've definitely had other nurses that have had patients who were going in for a C-section third or fourth time, Jehovah's Witness. So that's typically the one that we're going to see on labor and delivery, where it is related to religious beliefs. And ended up in the ICU, wouldn't receive blood products. So at that point, we do everything we can to make sure we are giving prophylactic medications to prevent bleeding. And if bleeding does occur, we're respecting those wishes and then transferring them to a higher level of care, because we know that we can't give those products that we would typically give for life-saving measures.
Mm-hmm. We focused on the people who are the known high risk. They've been effectively evaluated. Their risk factors are lined up. The staff are aware. But I have heard about sneaky, delayed postpartum hemorrhages in people who are low risk, when all of a sudden there's bleeding that the staff didn't anticipate. Tell us about that phenomenon, because that sounds like one that could easily lead to litigation, particularly if the woman ended up bleeding either presumably in the hospital, or with our push to get people out of the hospital as fast as possible, maybe started bleeding at home. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. So that's typically what we would call a delayed postpartum hemorrhage. So your standard postpartum hemorrhage happens between birth and about 24 hours. Depending on who you talk to, you may get a little bit of a different answer. Typically, you're going to hear delayed postpartum hemorrhage is either 24 hours after delivery, all the way up to 6 weeks postpartum, or 48 hours after delivery, all the way up to 12 weeks postpartum. Any combination of those is a delayed postpartum hemorrhage. With that, it's typically going to be either your low-risk patients that you just weren't expecting to bleed, or your first-time moms. So you just don't have the history behind it. So now that they've had a postpartum hemorrhage, if they get pregnant again, they will be automatically a medium risk for postpartum hemorrhage. When you have a patient that bleeds after that 24-hour period, it is typically, not always, but typically going to be because there is some sort of retained product that you just can't predict. And by retained product, I don't mean like an instrument that we've left inside. I mean retained product of conception. So perhaps a piece of the placenta did not come off of the uterine lining. Possibly a piece of the amniotic sac was left inside. And our bodies are very smart, but also not so smart, because they know that something is left inside and it needs to come out. And the way that our bodies do that, specifically in the uterus, is by bleeding, trying to flush it out of the body, because it knows that if it stays, we're going to get an infection, possibly become septic. So what will happen is your bleeding will be fine. And then 24, 48 hours after delivery, all of a sudden you'll have a sudden increase. If you're in the hospital, luckily you've got a nurse that's assessing you usually every 4 to 8 hours, rubbing your fundus, which is just the top of your uterus, making sure that tone is nice and firm, and then also checking in your underwear and making sure that there's not bleeding coming out. We're not seeing lots of clots. The other thing we're going to tell you is if you're changing your pad, if you're going through one of those large maxi pads in less than an hour, you need to let the nurse know so that we can assess what's going on. If you do have retained product, typically what will happen is if it's at that point, the cervix is already closed back up. So you can't really do a manual sweep of the uterus to get it out like you could immediately after delivery. So what will happen is you'll typically need to go in and have a DNC done. Or you'll need to get some sort of medication to help you get that out. But I would say typically we see patients having to go back into the OR and get a DNC done. For your patients that have gone home, the biggest thing you can do as the postpartum nurse is educate, educate, educate. Make sure that your patient knows what a hemorrhage is and goes into the ER or calls the OB clinic and lets them know what's going on, because it's life-threatening. If you don't know that there's a retained product, you go into the ER and they don't know what they're looking for. And you go in and they think, oh, she's septic. but they don't know that you've just had a baby and that you're bleeding, you can treat the sepsis, but if you don't get that product out, you're not going to fix this person. You're not going to help save them. So that's the biggest thing is when you're sending somebody home, just educate them on why and when to come back into the ER.
Oh, I can see potential suits involving moms who call the OB office and are dismissed. Their concerns are dismissed. That could be potentially life-threatening if the severity of the situation isn't recognized.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And then in terms of the signs of bleeding, obviously lab work will change. But what are some of the things that a nurse who's working on postpartum or a nurse who's working in that OB office and talking to the mother, what are some of those things that they should be asking the patient to determine if the patient's bleeding, other than what you already covered?
Sure. So if you've got a patient specifically that's on the phone calling saying, hey, I think I'm bleeding more than I should be, or I've had an increase in bleeding than what has been happening the last few days, the nurse needs to be asking, are you feeling dizzy? Are you feeling lightheaded? Is your vision going blurry? Are you nauseous? Have you been vomiting? Are you pale and clammy? Are you having abdominal pain? Those are pretty easy questions to ask. If they are saying yes to any of those and they're stating that they are bleeding more, trust them, send them to the ER. Once that patient gets to the ER, they need to make sure that they are telling that triage nurse, the first person they see, I had a baby on this date. I think I'm having a postpartum hemorrhage. Because the best thing you can do as a patient is advocate for yourself. And if you think that you know what's happening, tell them that so they can assess and either rule it out or rule it in. Once you get to the ER, I think sometimes pregnant patients and also postpartum patients can scare ER nurses because that's just out of their wheelhouse, and that's okay. But the biggest things for them to do is touch the patient, look at the patient, and look at the bleeding. I would say 90% of my patients that come in, they have a picture of their bleeding or they have brought in the blood clots in a plastic bag. So like, ask and look at it. And then we were talking about lab work. Something that is very specific to pregnant patients is pregnant and recently postpartum is we are in a very highly coagulable state. So drawing your CBC and drawing a coag panel is going to be very important because you need to look at their hematocrit, their hemoglobin. If those are decreased and their platelets are decreased, especially if they're under that 50,000 range, we know they're at a high risk. So if you see those, immediately draw a coag panel. When you draw a coag panel for a pregnant person, the two things that I find providers are going to look at is their PTINR. Is that increased? And then also look at their fibrinogen and has that decreased? Because a pregnant or recently postpartum person can have a fibrinogen up to 500-600, which is, you know, way out of the norm of a non-pregnant patient. So if you have somebody that comes back and their fibrinogen is less than 200, less than 150, it may, when you're looking at the normal lab values, it may still be within range of a normal non-pregnant person, but you've got to remember that's very low for your pregnant or your postpartum patient. And so that's going to trigger your thought, is this patient going into DIC, which is that disseminated intravascular coagulation, which is a whole nother topic, but those are very important lab values to be looking at when you're thinking or even suspecting an inkling of postpartum hemorrhage.
When you were talking about how that patient was feeling and then sending them to the ER, my immediate thought was, oh, I hope that they're calling an ambulance or somebody in their family is driving them. Because it doesn't sound safe to be driving if you're lightheaded, dizzy, pale, clammy, nausea, vomiting. That's a whole setup for a different kind of case, a motor vehicle crash. What about the role of shoulder pain in helping to diagnose whether a person is bleeding? That seems a little odd when we're talking about a uterine bleeding to have shoulder pain. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So shoulder pain it's pretty interesting. So first I'm going to talk about Kerr's sign, which is the occurrence of acute pain in like the shoulder or the tip of the shoulder. And that's typically going to be due to blood accumulating in the peritoneal cavity. And the way that you assess for the Kerr's sign is you lie your patient down and you lift their legs up. And if that, it's very weird, if that happens, that typically is a good indicator that there is blood pooling in that cavity. For your pregnant patients, it's going to be most common in your previous cesarean patients that are either in labor, so they've come into triage and they're laboring, or your TOLAC patients who are there for an induction, again, laboring, they had an incision on their uterus, maybe they have an epidural. So what you would typically find with a uterine rupture is the patient has extreme abdominal pain, because again, that uterus is ripping apart at that incision. However, if you have a patient that has an epidural in place, they're not going to feel that ripping sensation. So they may have some abdominal discomfort, but it will be hidden by that epidural. So if you have a patient who's had a previous C-section, and then all of a sudden they're complaining like my shoulder is just aching, it's killing me, it's severe, you need to be assessing quickly, look at your fetal heart tones. Are things starting to go wrong? Because with the uterine rupture, you may not have any vaginal bleeding. It may all be pooling into that peritoneal cavity. So it's a very strange sign, but it's very important as a labor and delivery nurse to be cognizant that that could be one of your first indicators that there is blood pooling in that cavity.
Yeah, I've worked on a couple of uterine rupture cases that turned into litigation. They are devastating to the woman and devastating to the infant who is deprived of blood flow and oxygen for a period. I remember one in which the woman survived. The infant lived for 2 years on life support in a pediatric hospital because the family who was torn apart by this couldn't allow the child to be taken off life support. They couldn't come to terms with the fact that their child had no hope of recovery. So he was on life support for 2 years. And then the hospital was able to train the family to take this child home. And he lasted for 12 hours at home before he died at home. He had been so unstable in the hospital with various types of complications that no matter how well trained they were at home, the home care nurses couldn't manage the complications that he had the way that the nurses in the pediatric ICU did for 2 years. It's just a tragic case. Well, let's, in the remaining time, we've got just a couple more minutes. Let me ask you about some other causes of bleeding after delivery that could factor into a poor outcome for the mother.
Sure. So one of the catchphrases, if you want to call it, thing for that postpartum bleeding is called the four T's of postpartum hemorrhage. So it's thrombin, tissue, tone, and trauma. So some of those are kind of the things that you might think about, like, oh, did you tear during labor, you know, or during delivery, something very straightforward like that. But, you know, with thrombin, we're looking like, is that mom preeclamptic? Are there other things going on? Preeclamptic, HELLP syndrome. Does she have any other underlying bleeding disorders? And again, a lot of times we have those young, healthy adult patients and they're like, I guess I'm proving healthy until proven otherwise. For most people, you know, pregnancy is the first time that they've ever gotten a lot of, you know, really in-depth hands-on medical care in their life. So we do discover quite a few things during pregnancy that you're like, oh, you I'm surprised you didn't know that, but here's this knowledge for future reference. And then as we were talking about with the tissue for that retained pieces of the placenta, retained anything that is left up there. products of conception, Accreta. Typically, any patients with an Accreta, they will always end up in the operating room. And everyone that I've ever even been in the hospital for, every single one of them has been an OB emergency, no matter how well planned for they were, no matter how many hands and prep that we had done. They are always an emergency that is called overhead. So for those, you just manage as best as you can and hope for a good outcome. The tones of the having, if your uterus is too relaxed, so sometimes during labor, we give uterine relaxants. If baby looks really, really stressed or having, you know, on top of each other contractions, we can give uterine relaxants such as terbutaline to help space out those contractions and give mom and baby a break. It's not great if then you deliver immediately afterwards. Now your uterus is like, I'm relaxed. And, you know, that's the point where you don't necessarily need your uterus to be relaxed. Overdistension of the uterus. So if you have polyhydramnio, so too much fluid, you have a really big baby, multiples obviously overdistend your uterus past what it is really kind of designed for. You know, so those are some of those risk factors going in where you're like, hey, you know, I have twins or I have triplets. She's probably going to bleed a little bit more than your average singleton mom. Trauma is any type of trauma. A C-section is trauma, an episiotomy, any type of tears all the way from that first degree all the way to a fourth degree, a cervical laceration, those bleed a lot. You know, and things like fourth degrees and cervical lacerations, those are, you have typically go to the operating room to do the repair on those. If you have any uterine fibroids, those, you know, because they're still in the uterus, it can really impede the uterus's ability to clamp down well and control that bleeding. And again, some patients do not know that they have really large uterine fibroids until you're postpartum and we can't get your bleeding to stop, especially, you know, if they didn't interfere with your ability to get pregnant or anything like that. Mm. Other things that we see, typically if you have a really long labor, especially with an induction, you know, we give Pitocin as one of our induction of labor methods. Your uterus only has so many Pitocin receptors. And if, you know, you're at the end of a 3-day induction with more than likely a lot of Pitocin, you get to postpartum and we give Pitocin as a postpartum hemorrhage management medication. Those receptors are like, I'm tapped out. I don't have any more ability to receive any more of this Pitocin. So I'm done. You know, so then your uterus is like, I need help. But the help you're trying to give me isn't the help that I necessarily need. You know, so that's when we use our postpartum hemorrhage cascade flow sheet to help us kind of move through it quickly so you can get other medications that, you know, your body will hopefully respond to better. Patients can also have, again, undiagnosed cancer, tumors. You know, unfortunately, the uterus is kind of like it's a mysterious place where, you know, most people assume that everything's working and doing what it's supposed to until it's not. And then you kind of have to go on a scavenger hunt to figure out what, you know, what is the issue and what's the right combination of treatments, you know, to stop our bleeding and or treat the patient appropriately. I think that's pretty much everything for most of those, at least like those kind of like big things that you would really, really think of. Labor and delivery is kind of black and white, but it's also a very much a gray area. So, you know, obviously looking at each patient as their own individual person with their own unique set of circumstances versus getting really caught up in your algorithms and, you know, what should be happening versus what is actually happening in front of you.
I know with what you just outlined, Sasha, that our viewer is going to be sitting here thinking, isn't it wonderful when everything works properly? We have a normal delivery, a healthy mom, a healthy baby, no complications. And yet, you've pointed out in this podcast that there are many things that can go wrong. And we've just looked at one piece of this, which is bleeding issues. Mm-hmm. I know that legal nurse consultants listening to this who are approached by attorneys might be interested in being able to reach you to serve as expert witnesses or behind-the-scenes consultants. Sasha, what would be the best way for people to reach you?
Actually, Courtney has our email address written down. Sorry.
All right, Courtney, what would be the best way?
Absolutely. So either reaching out on LinkedIn, you can find me at Courtney Morehouse, and my last name is Morhouse, or at Alexandra Benner. Sasha, her full name is Alexandra, but she goes by Sasha. And if you wanted to send us an email directly, you could email us at Nightingale, like Florence Nightingale, consulting, CLNC, at gmail.com.
All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate everything that you have shared. You have made me appreciate that my childbearing years are well behind me and I don't have to think about any of these things on a personal level. I know that this is a fertile area for litigation, if you'll forgive the use of the adjective, and that it is a complicated area where LNCs are best served helping attorneys with people like you who understand the dynamics and can easily establish your credibility and function as experts. Thanks so much for being my guests on Legal Nurse Podcast.
Thank you so much for having us.
And for you who's watching this, please hang on for just another couple of seconds while we introduce you to the guests for next week's show. Also, I am accumulating pictures of where our podcast listeners are listening to our show. So please send in a picture to me at patiyer@legalnursebusiness.com and show me where do you typically listen to Legal Nurse Podcast. I look forward to receiving that. Thanks so much. Coming up on Legal Nurse Podcast, you're going to have an opportunity to get some tips from me on how you as an expert witness can get more cases. There are 9 tips that I'm going to be sharing in this podcast that will help you focus in on what can you be doing to build your authority and credibility and spread the word about the expert witness services you provide. Stay tuned, coming up next on Legal Nurse Podcast. Thank you for watching this episode of Legal Nurse Podcast. Be sure to go to the link below this video, which is lnc.tips/expert-witness-course. You'll get the information that you need to sign up for our live expert witness course taking place during the month of May 2024, every week for 4 weeks in the evening in Eastern time to get the skills, the knowledge, the support that you need to expand your practice as a nursing expert witness. I would love to see you in the course.